Accession number 19909, Reel 1.
Warwick Taylor, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
I was born in Harrow in Middlesex in 1926.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Harrow area?
Yes, I went to a preparatory school in Harrow, and then for my secondary education I went to Watford Grammar School in Watford. And as a matter of interest, my classmate who sat next to me for 3 years was called Owen Scott, better known as Terry Scott, the late famous actor and comedian.
What was he like as a boy?
Strangely enough, the acting talents were there. They showed in those early days, because for English we used to have to do a Shakespearean play, and he always got the major role. If it was Henry the Fourth Part One, he got the part of Henry the Fourth, you know. And the early signs show that he had the acting ability even then.
Did he have a sense of humour in those days?
Not really, no. He was quite serious, as it happened, you know. And of course, the reason that we sat next to each other was the fact that he was Scott, I was Taylor, and we used to sit alphabetically in those days. I remember though, that at Watford Grammar School, that sitting in class, because the war had started then, during the time that I was there, and we used to sit looking at the army lorries going by, convoy after convoy of army lorries. They'd obviously come from the Vauxhall Bedford Works at Luton, which is interesting. It rather distracted our attention to paying attention in class.
Was your schooling much disrupted by the war?
Yes, it was. And especially in the early days, 1939, 1940, because every time the air raid siren went, we had to go down to emergency shelters, where, of course, this very much disrupted education. And you'd return back to class when the all-clear went, and you'd find the air raid siren would go again, and back you'd go downstairs to the shelters. So very much disrupted, yes.
Was the availability of suitable staff affected by war?
Well, for grammar school, we had actually 28 masters, and none of them were called up for war service at all, probably because of their age. Call up, when they had this massive mobilisation in 1939, one had to be more or less between the age of 18 and 25, so at first, but this altered and it increased as time went on. But I think that the masters were considered a reserved occupation.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
3rd of September 1939, a Sunday, yes. We all sat glued to our radios. There was no television, of course, anybody who had TV in those days, it was very rare, it was a luxury. So we all listened to the radio and we heard the actual broadcast of Neville Chamberlain.
How did you and the rest of the family react?
It was a shock, although we did know this was coming, because there was a build-up to the war. We had actually a year's grace, because we started to take precautions beforehand from 1938. The issue of civilian respirators, for instance, gas masks that everybody had to have, and identity cards. This was all done in the build-up to 1939. So it was pretty inevitable that the war was coming.
Was there ever any question of your being evacuated from Watford?
No, not some. Most of the evacuees came from either the east end of London or the south, where, of course, these areas would be nearer to the continent of Europe, because we'd be more liable to bombing raids and such like. They were at greater risk than being north of London.
Was Watford area hit at all during the bombing?
There was some stray bombs. In fact, any part of north London was any bombs that did fall. It was really sort of an overshoot, because basically, it was the docks and the east end of London that was the major target. And, of course, south coast areas as well.
Did any bombs fall near your home or school?
Yes, they did. When we lived in Harrow, a Junkers 88 flew over low, and I think it was probably either trying to get rid of his bombs. A Junkers 88 carried four bombs, and we had a new church. It was like a square tower. He may have mistaken it for a factory, and he released all four bombs on this church. He failed to hit it. But it left. It did damage the house. We lived a matter of, 100 yards from the house, and it did actually broke a few windows, and it made the chimney stack a bit skew-iff. So the area was actually sealed off for a few days in any event.
What was your address?
The address at that time? It was at number 124, the Ridgeway, in North Harrow. North Harrow was much one of the areas that was designated as a part of metro land, which was built up in the 1920s and 1930s. It was all country. When we first moved there in 1931, it was very much countrified. Green grass, you could look right across to Harrow on the hill, a mile and a half away. Whereas today, of course, it's completely built up. You won't see a blade of grass at all. Everything's completely changed. When war was declared, a lot of emergency powers came into being and a lot of things were happening. I remember going up to the local public house and we were filling sandbags in the car park. Anybody and everybody could do this sort of thing. Just keep on filling up sandbags. It was endless. You know, there were thousands and thousands of these canvas bags to be filled with sand. It went on and on. Delivering of leaflets at school, at Watford Grammar School, we were sent out to deliver leaflets for economy measures. One should conserve water. I think the regulation was the recommended amount was 9 inches of bath water, no more. And conservation of electricity, what to do in an air raid, for instance, and this kind of thing. And we spent our time delivering these things to all the houses in Watford.
So this was unpaid work?
We did actually get paid for it. Yes, I think it was 5 shillings or something for the day. Well worth it, better than sitting in class. We all thoroughly enjoyed it. And of course, the school itself, they had blast walls built, netting put up to the windows. When war was declared, everybody started putting tape across their windows to help minimise blast from glass flying about. It was the same on the trains, of course. They put this thick... on the underground in London, you had all this very, very thick sort of gummy gauze that they put on the windows of the carriages to prevent any blast. So if there was an explosion, the whole window would just come out and you wouldn't be injured by broken glass. That was the object of it.
Any other memories from this time?
At that particular time, I was in the Air Training Corps. You've got to realise that I was only 13 when war was declared and I was in the Air Training Corps, and my whole object, of course, was to, when war came, was to eventually go into the Royal Air Force, which I'd really set my heart on. I was a very, very keen cadet in the Air Training Corps, and radio was my particular interest, and I studied this and was building my own radio sets, starting off with the crystal and then going onto the valves. I thoroughly enjoyed this. I was really looking forward to going into the Royal Air Force eventually. However, schooling finished. I sat for my school certificate, as it was then. And I left school and I got a job as a junior clerk with a firm of exporters and importers in Pinner, which is Pinner, Middlesex, only a mile away from North Harrow, where we lived. And this job was a 5.5 day... We worked in a converted country house, because in those days most of the offices in London moved out into the country to avoid any bombing, of course. And we worked in this beautiful country house. And it was a 5.5 day week. My salary was £78 per annum, which of course is, in today's terms, £1.25 a week. It seems a pretty poor money for those days. And we had to work hard, you know. And part of the job, every third week, I had to go up by train to the London office in the city. And this could be a bit risky because all that one saw in the city was... You didn't walk down roads, you just walked across bomb sites. Because all this had been flattened in 1940. And this is what I had to do in each third week, was to go up to with this massive suitcase and conveying documents to the various shipping agencies in and around the city of London. This was at a place called, just off the Minories, which in those days the local station was called Mark Lane, but of course today it's been renamed to Tower Hill. And it's a small wonder that the office there in London wasn't bombed, because everything around it was. During the war, there was various schemes to raise money. They had Wings for Victory Week, for instance, and a Navy Week and an Army Week. All this was to raise funds for the war effort. And another scheme they had was called the Mile of Pennies. Now, they had this in Pinner. Now, everybody had to contribute a penny, and it was laid out in the main high street. It went up one side of the high street to the top and down the other, this Mile of Pennies, and people could keep adding a penny to the war effort. But the amazing part was that it was left there overnight. Nobody came along and stole the money at all. Next morning it would be just there and added to, which is amazing in those days. There was no sort of dishonesty at all like that. Everybody had a common objective during wartime. That was the war effort, to win the war.
Did you ever come across any crime or misdemeanor in the war years?
No, I suppose the only crime that I ever committed, I had a girlfriend. I was very fond of in those days. And I remember picking, she worked for the hairdressers, and I picked her up on my bicycle, put her on the crossbar of the bike to the bus stop to catch a bus, and the police stopped us. We were arrested, taken up to the local police station. We weren't charged, fortunately. We were given a caution, and we had to produce our identity cards within 24 hours. We didn't carry our identity cards with us, but you had to produce these. Everybody had a civilian identity card during wartime. But it just goes to show, doesn't it? You know, arrested for sort of a petty thing like that, carrying a girlfriend on the crossbar of your bike.
So, this was in Harrow, was it?
This was in Pinner. Yes, this was in Pinner. I think all these places today, they all come under the sort of the more or less part of the London borough now.
How were the police regarded in those days?
Police were everywhere in those days. There were a lot of special constables during wartime, because I suppose a lot of the normal constables of call up age were called into the forces. So you found a lot of older constables in the special constabulary during wartime. And they were everywhere, and of course, police could challenge you quite often for your identity card. In wartime, everybody was sort of on alert to be very suspicious about some people around you. You know, one had to be careful of enemy agents that could be posing in civilian dress.
But how did the public regard the police?
Oh, I think with respect. Oh, yes, the police were. They were there doing their job, and there was no animosity towards the police at all. Funny enough, strangely, in those days, that we had all this problem with trains today, but the train services seemed to be quite efficient in wartime. It was amazing, you know. They basically used to run on time and were regular.
Were they not disrupted by the bomb?
Yes, they could be. Yes, this could happen, of course. You could, if you had a bombing on the track, this would caused total disruption. But it didn't take long to get things back running again. You know, everybody, you had a lot of emergency services during wartime, the fire services, the ambulance, rescue services. bomb disposal services. There'd be a lot of... during wartime, a lot of the bombs failed to explode. Now, this is really, I think, due to the in Germany, in the factories, they've employed a lot of foreign workers, such as Polish, Czechs, and they were really basically anti-German and sort of had a leaning towards the British, and I think a lot of dud fuses went into these bombs, hence they didn't explode. But of course, nevertheless, of course, they had to be treated with extreme caution.
What happened to you next? Because you were doing this job in Pinner.
Time came, of course, I was approaching call-up age. The firm I worked for were a little bit crafty because they used to keep saying, have you had your call-up papers yet? Because, you see, if you were called up and you were in a civilian job, it was mandatory that they held open your job for you after you were demobilised from the services. And I don't think this firm was very particularly keen on that. And they kept asking, you know, have you had your call-up papers yet? And if you said yes, they used to find some excuse about giving you the push, sacking you over. Anyway, I was called for to attend for call-up. My papers came through. It said, you've got to register now for your national service in the forces. I went to Ryslip, which is the place I had to attend to register. And I always remember him saying to me, oh, hard luck, chum. You've been balloted to go in the coal mines. I said, what? Oh, no. I said, I'm going to the RAF. I'm ex-Air Training Corps. They said, well, sorry, your number's been drawn. Now, these numbers were drawn every fortnight. And it was based on the last digit of your registration number. If that coincided with the number drawn, you were in the coal mines. And that's what happened to me. And this was August of 1944. And I came away a bit stunned. Of course, I immediately appealed on this. I said, I remember my mother saying, you're not going. My father saying, he's got to go, you know, it's National War Service, he's got to go. I appealed, but any amount of appealing just falls on deaf ears. It was refused.
What was the method of appealing?
You wrote to the Ministry of Labour and National Service, and quoted your grounds for appealing. And they answer you and say, well, it's been considered. But then you get a reply saying, you know, they don't even call you to a tribunal. They didn't in my case.
What grounds did you mention?
The grounds that I appealed on was the fact that I wanted to go in the Royal Air Force, that I'd done pre-service training, and I was almost a qualified radio operator. But this didn't do any good at all. They said, no, this is it. It's a direction order issued by the Ministry of Labour and National Service, and you have no choice. Next thing I received, of course, were the papers to attend for a medical examination. Now, all the medicals for the North London area took place in Horn Lane, Acton, which was a Territorial Army drill hall. Had a medical exam, A1 fit, because virtually everybody was A1 fit in those days. The next thing that I received after about a fortnight, 3 weeks, was this buff envelope with my reporting instructions, the direction order and a railway warrant to report to a government training centre in Wales. There were 13 of these government training centres, one in Scotland, one in Wales and 11 in England, and I was sent to the one in Wales because that's obviously where they allocated me to. I think I actually appealed yet again, but that again it was the same answer. The day came to set off from Harrow to attend this place in Oakdale in South Wales. Set off, my little bag of the things, the requirements that they asked us to take with us. I think the basic things that all they were worried about in those days was to take your identity card and your ration book and your clothing coupons. I'll tell you about more about that in a moment. Off to Paddington Station, and I caught the train down to Newport, which in those days was in Monmouthshire. At Newport, I had to change trains and catch a local train up one of the valleys to a place called Newbridge. That line, of course, is long since gone, doesn't exist now. When we detrained at Newbridge, you then realised that there were other youngsters of your own age, and don't forget that by now we're 18 years of age, of course, now. And you saw other youngsters all there getting out of the train with the same plight. On the station, there'd be a Ministry of Labour official who would welcome you and say, right, there's a bus waiting. I'm now going to take you up to your accommodation. Now, the accommodation at Oakdale was a hostel. Now, there were lots of these hostels that were run by the National Service Hostels Association Corporation. They were purpose-built. They were like army camps. Nissen huts with brick buildings for the cookhouse, sick bay, a lounge and sort of social facilities, this kind of thing. If there wasn't a hostel, then you would be billeted out to a local billets in the town. We arrived at the hostel, and then we were allocated our hut, where we'd have to. There'd be a locker there provided and a bed space. I think there were about 12 beds per billet in each Nissen hut. A meal. You had actually vouchers for your meals, I seem to remember. Next day, you would then have to report to the training centre. Now, first thing that they do is to kit you out. You'd receive a miner's helmet, a boiler suit, and a pair of steel-capped boots, for which you had to surrender 6 clothing coupons. The next thing was to get you into a classroom and explain the programme for the month that you'd spend. You spend 4 weeks at this particular training centre. After that, you would then be allocated to another colliery within the area where you're trained for another 2 weeks before you started work. However, the object was to give you 20% of classroom work, 30% underground, 25% of the time would be spent giving you physical training. Now, this physical training was normally done by ex-Army, Navy or Air Force drill instructors, because it was very important to get you fit. And the other 25% of the time would be spent on other things, either surface, underground, classroom, etc. The first 3 weeks that we were there, they said, right, we're putting you on other duties. There was heavy snow at that time. And don't forget, this is we're now into November of 1944. Heavy snow. They said, we want you all on the railway tracks, shoveling snow, clearing the tracks. And that's what we did for 3 weeks. Of course, this put the whole training program out of sync. So we had to, after this, start again. Training started, and I think we will all remember the first time that we went underground. It was called the initiation drop. Suitably kitted out. We all got into the cage. That's the lift, which takes you down underground. Now, the colliery at Oakdale was 985 yards deep. That's quite a depth. We all got into this cage, and we had a miner with us, and he said, they're going to let you drop, so bend your knees. Won't feel so bad. Now, I remember the chap, the person in charge of the cage is known as the banksman. Because before you enter the cage, you've got to have a lamp with you, and to get the lamp, you submit a lamp check. This is to so they've got an indication of who's underground. They want to keep a check on who's below ground for safety reasons, of course. So we're all kitted out, ready to go. And I remember the Welshman saying, and he's in contact, don't forget, with the man below and the engine house. Okay, die, he said. We got the Bevin boys on board. Let them go. Right out, Taff. And they just let us drop. Apparently the regulation speed is 30 feet per second. But they let us drop at 70 feet per second. And that is not very pleasant. Because it causes nosebleeds and a tremendous pressure on the eardrums.
Anyway, why did they want to let you drop at a faster speed?
They called it the initiation drop. It's a bit of a joke, I think, on the part of the regular miners. They thought, hello, here's a whole group of youngsters, you know, newcomers to it. Let's let them know what it's about. All done as a prank, really. Anyway, we finally, as the cage starts to slow up near the bottom, you still think you've left your stomach up on the surface. And we then got out of the cage, and then these cages, by the way, hold something like 40 or 50. We then were surrounded by this huge tunnel, which was whitewashed. We thought, this isn't so bad, but of course, this was the training area. And we were given a sort of familiarisation on the types of training down there. And after that, I think we spent about 2 or 3 hours there on the first day, of course, this is the first time, and then they showed us around, we went through all the different tunnels and roadways, as they're called, and then back up onto the surface. Of course, fortunately, this particular colliery had pithead bars, which is really a luxury to have pithead bars on the site, because if you didn't have pithead bars, you'd have to either go back to your hostel to take a shower, or if you didn't have a hostel, you'd have to go back to your local billets. And usually these billets were held in miners' houses, and that meant you probably had to take your turn to use the zinc bath in front of the fire. So the idea of course, of pithead baths is that you have a clean and dirty side, and when you come on duty, you take your clean clothes off, cross over with your soap and towel, put your overalls on, and away you go. When you come up, take your dirty clothes off, you can then have a shower, move over to the clean side and put your clean clothes on, and away. Quite an efficient system. Training went on day after day, the physical training. I remember one morning, we snow about. It was about half a mile to walk from the hostel to the colliery, to the classroom. And we were a little bit late. We had to trudge through the snow, and you had to be in the classroom by 8 o'clock, and we arrived at 8:10. Instructor said, you're late. I mean, what, the six of you? You're all late. He said, you lose a day's pay. So feeling quite bold in those days as a youngster of 18, I said, right, if we lose a day's pay, what are we staying for, lads? Let's all clear off to the town. So we did. So I think that that form of treatment was short-lived. They realised that there's no good threatening us with losing a day's pay.
Did you suffer any consequences from doing that?
No, we didn't. No, there was no reprisals or anything for doing that. The third week of training, I had a very, very nasty cold. And I went down, I did training down there, I was down there about 6 hours, and I was working in water up to my ankles. And I felt really rough. Came up. I went to bed because I felt a temperature coming on. The next morning came, and the warden came around and said, come on up, get up, you know, no.